Welcome to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder
and Josh Hughes.
This podcast may contain swearing, plus it will be filled with lots of interesting chat.
All the views are expressed are our own and are not those of our institutions or employers. You're welcome to share your own views in the comment box on the website.
And if you like what you hear, please like, share and subscribe. And you can find out more on our website, innerzonepodcast.com.
Or on Spotify, iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also like us on Facebook.
So, without further ado, here's this week's episode. Hi, and welcome to the latest episode of the Inner Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
So in this episode, we're going to talk about a space force. And something that's been in the news recently with America's new space force set up and a new logo, which has been hitting the headlines.
Yeah, so there's two sort of aesthetic issues, aren't there?
Yes.
Recently. So the first one was... the US Space Force Twitter account tweeted a picture of their new uniforms, which were woodland uniforms.
Yes, woodland camouflage.
Hilariously, you know, there aren't woodlands in space, so what are they going to camouflage themselves from?
Well, not the space that we've been to yet, anyway.
Yeah, actually, it's perhaps less funny in reality, because, of course, they're going to be inside of spaceships, so they don't actually need to camouflage themselves from anything.
Well, no, there is that, and I suppose it's just they happen to have a lot of green uniforms there, you'd imagine.
I feel like it's just a missed opportunity to create something spectacular.
Yeah, especially given the new logo that's gone alongside the Space Force.
This is the other aesthetic issue, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think this is absolutely fascinating, actually. I mean, a lot of people have reacted strongly to it, but I think in terms of the background to this, I think it's very interesting. But basically, the new Space Force logo looks like the Federation logo from Star Trek. It looks so much like it could have just been sort of copy-pasted with different words.
Yeah.
It's fair to say. Which has obviously brought about a great many responses. I mean, obviously, George Takei, big sort of voice on social media, has obviously made some comment. But, I mean, I know a lot of sort of science fiction scholars. I know some Trekkie fans. Hi, Daniel, if you're listening. But it just seems bizarre that they would so blatantly rip off the Federation, which is the thing that really fascinates me, I think.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, we'll get into it later about how the idea of the Space Force isn't quite as silly as it sounds.
Mm. You know?
Copying the sort of the Star Trek logo and the way some people sort of view it, they're viewing it as like this, you know, we're going to be space marines, we're going to go and fight aliens.
Mm.
And so it seems to be this complete disconnect between what this Space Force is actually going to do and how it's being understood, one, by the public, but also how it's being presented by the Pentagon.
Yeah, so there are a lot of different issues here. I don't know where to start, actually. I mean, one is the power of normalisation. I mean, Star Trek in itself has been a massive power for this in terms of making the everyday individual more willing to accept new technology, for example, in the home. So like the idea of sort of computers in the home, sort of tricorders, handheld technological devices. Science fiction in general, and Star Trek specifically, has been a massive power in this normalising force of technology. It makes us more accepting of the new things that come along. So in a sense, there's a sense that, well, this new Space Force logo is in a way of trying to normalise the idea of a Space Force, because obviously we've been talking about it now for many decades.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's also, obviously they're being a bit cheeky, because I think they're sort of deliberately trying to play on the positive
view of Star Trek,
yeah. I mean, obviously there's also this other thing with Star Trek, in that obviously the Federation is supposedly, inverted commas, peaceful. I think there are actually many issues with the concept of the Federation, which I'm not going to go into here, but it's a very utopian idea of what peace actually is. Obviously, it's got to have some positives to that as well. But I think, as well, at the same time, yeah. So what is it exactly that the Space Force is supposed to stand for? And this is the question mark here, I think. Are the Americans just essentially trying to cash in on the good feeling towards Star Trek, generally speaking, and essentially saying, okay, this is our logo. We're going to be just like it is in Star Trek.
Well, I think in terms of the aesthetic. I think, probably, because it's a bit familiar. Well, yeah, I think sort of the idea of Star Trek is quite familiar to people, well, to Trekkies, obviously, but mm. also to people who are kind of maybe dipping out and know a little bit about Star Trek, which mm. is probably most people. Most everyone's heard of it, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it kind of, yeah, it seems a bit more familiar than the idea of a Space Force. It just seems like, what the bloody hell is that about? We'll dig into that a bit, but yeah, I think making that link with Star Trek, I think, seems... Well, it seems to be a smart move if you want people to accept...
Buy into a concept,
yeah. Yeah. But the fact that the concept that is related to Star Trek is very different from the actual concept.
Yeah, which is the funny thing, because you're calling it a space force, and obviously the word force is quite a military word. Force, power, violence, maybe, and align it with Star Trek, which is typically not supposed to be like that. Obviously, the Americans have got some PR issues going on here. I think what this does raise as well is something that I didn't pre-warn you about before the show, is this idea of the difference between the Space Force and maybe the Air Force, and the links, the long-term links actually between the Air Force and rockets and war and the space race. So essentially, there's always been this disconnect. Well, actually, there's been a close connection, sorry, more to the point, between war, so we created rockets, V2 rockets, and then the space race. And then it's like, well, there's a question of, well, is that the jurisdiction, as it were, of the Air Force, or should that be a separate entity altogether? Obviously, previously, it's thinking, well, it's the Air Force because it's flying, but actually it's going into outer space. So do we draw a line before sort of terrestrial operations and operations in space? Which is a big question, I think.
Mm.
Just before I let you come in on that, the motto of the British RAF is "Through Adversity to the Stars,"
yeah.
Which in itself I think is quite interesting because it automatically suggests space.
Yeah, because as you were saying, sort of there's deep links between the idea of the Space Force and the Air Force, because for the past few decades, the US Air Force, I think its full title, or at least its official sort of understanding, has been Air and Space Force.
Mm.
Because the idea of the Space Force, well, what the US Space Force is now was just a part of the US Air Force.
Mm.
It used to be a Space Command,
mm.
which dealt with what the Space Force is now going to deal with. It's just basically taking bits of the US Air Force and giving them a new title.
So would they have terrestrial powers, do we think? Like, in the same way that the Air Force might, sort of jurisdictions, or is it going to be so completely separate?
I don't know.
We don't know. No, because it's still early days, isn't it? I just wondered if you'd had any insights into that. Because obviously there's so much blurring already, because a lot of the stuff that armed forces across the globe does have some link with space.
Yeah.
I'm thinking specifically sort of GPS, satellites, maps, for example, all of this links to outer space in a way. Not even actually sort of high-level jets. I mean, at what point are you saying actually they're verging onto space territory here?
Yeah.
Thinking like the Blackbird spycraft, for example.
I mean, sort of the satellites is fundamentally what the Space Force is going to be bothered about. Mm. That's their basic role at the moment is to operate US military satellites
mm.
and to come up with ideas to deal with space junk.
Yeah.
That's basically their job. It's not, you know, going off and fighting the Russians in space and trying to find and kill aliens or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's not going to be, space marines with guns that work in space.
Yeah, I mean, it's fancy refuse collection at the moment, really.
Basically, yeah. It's probably going to be the worst job in the US military for at least 10 years. It's the first... hiving off of a space job into a separate force, and the US has done it. Whereas, you know, as you were saying, sort of the RAF from Adversity to the Stars, the UK sort of space military capability is under the purview of the RAF. And I think most countries, their space military capabilities are under the purview of their air forces.
Mm.
It's strange in a way to bother, because why would you do this now? You know, it's the same situation it was 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, nothing's changed, really.
So that would seem to imply that Trump has done it for political reasons.
Yeah.
But we don't need to get to that. It's kind of a bit of a... What should I say? It's a bit of a more prosaic thing than it would seem.
I mean, another question that sort of instantly springs to mind for me at least is, why is it still a military operation? Because essentially, I mean, we need to have Craig here to discuss this in more detail, because he probably got a better idea of this than we do. But in terms of the status of sort of war and law in outer space, because essentially, we're sort of neutral in space at the moment, aren't we? We're not supposed to really be taking war into outer space. And the idea of calling it a space force sort of implies actually we might start to
consider war as a domain.
Consider space as a territory for warfare.
So the international law has it. There's sort of a series of treaties and agreements about outer space that, you know, basically sort of agree that people won't station military vehicles in space, won't station nuclear weapons, won't use space for weapons testing and sort of military activities, basically, or for sort of for attacks and for operations and exercises, I think is what the agreement is. So obviously that doesn't negate or doesn't prohibit the use of sort of satellites, as we said, sort of military satellites, and they're, you know, they are really useful. That's why they still exist, because
imaging satellites, yeah. Well, I mean, surveillance, yeah.
Well, yeah, but even just communications, because you've got to bounce communication signals around the world.
Yeah.
And the Americans have to do it more than anyone else, because the biggest military and you know, intelligence agencies and everything else.
So. But then if you can just sort of switch off someone's communication, someone else's communications at a drop of a hat, it's quite interesting, isn't it? It's becoming a new geopolitical landscape, outer space, I think, and the control of these satellites. And
yeah, I mean, it's so in terms of sort of, how should I say, militarisation of outer space, there is actually an international law manual about hostilities in outer space being developed as we speak.
A manual?
Yeah, so one of the things that international lawyers like to talk about, so I've actually got one here.
Oh, have you? Oh, right, I did.
So I've got the Tallinn Manual on Cyber Warfare.
Wow.
Or Cyber Operation.
Manual
2.0. Manual 2.0, yeah. So basically when lots of international lawyers realise that there is a situation where people don't quite understand the rules, or they need some clarity or something like that, lots of experts tend to come together and thrash out the rules as they understand them. And like I was saying in the last podcast about civilians directly participating in hostilities, that was sort of an attempt to do another expert manual that didn't work out. So it's called the Woomera Manual. It's sponsored by Woomera University in Australia, I think. Yeah, and they're going to write a manual on the rules of warfare in outer space.
Why the Australians?
No idea.
I'm just fascinated by the fact that an Australian university is getting on back on that, when it's obviously not necessarily known as being an outer space powerhouse.
Well, yeah, but I guess it's just that all the other big domains have been done.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it, really?
Including, I was reading yesterday about a new book called Underground Warfare.
Well, yeah, there's that. I mean, you could think about subnautical warfare as well. I mean, there's whole swathes of the Earth that are basically barely touched. Obviously, you've got sort of naval sort of stuff, but then actually, at what point do you get so deep that actually it becomes a whole different area of operations?
Well, yeah, maybe that's something for a future podcast.
Submariners versus mariners. And it's, well, we're thinking about different forms of space. I mean, why aren't we thinking about a cyber force? That's what I want to know about.
Well, we do.
But I mean, there's not an actual military force called the cyber force, is there?
Well, I mean, there's US military command. US cyber command, sorry.
But yeah, but it's not actually cool. You don't say, I'm going to sign up to be part of Cyber Force.
You can do. I think you can do.
Can you?
Oh, well, maybe I don't know. Maybe it's, you have to be a...
I mean, it's an element of existing forces.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, it's not its own separate thing. You haven't. I mean, traditionally, you've got sort of Army, Navy, Air Force. We don't suddenly have Army, Navy, Air Force, Space Command, Cyber Force.
Well, you can. You can. What is it? You can actually enter the UK Cyber Reserve,
right?
Directly, you don't have to go through anything else.
Okay.
If you're a budding computer programmer and you're interested in cyber warfare and stuff and cyber operations, you could take a look online about that. Go to your local recruitment office.
What would you have to? That's just fascinates me actually, because just the concept just reminds me of that South Park episode of Warcraft. And I'm just thinking, I'm almost thinking of like sort of Warriors of Warcraft Unite. And it's like everyone takes to the battlefield in the World of Warcraft.
Because I was interested in learning about programming, and I thought, I wonder if I join them, will they teach me programming? And it turns out you actually have to know it already. So
yeah, but that's just interesting in itself. Cyber Reserve. I wonder what that would involve.
I don't know.
But as I say, my point being is actually there's a whole other sort of geospatial domain that really we don't see in the same light as we see air, ground, water. And if we're doing space, then why are we not doing maybe the technical, the sort of the actual cyber side just as seriously?
We are. I mean, like Stuxnet is.
I mean, I don't feel like to the general member of the public, it's not. I mean, you say we are because you're bowed up on this stuff, but
yeah, I think for the public, actually, I think maybe some of them do because you hear about cyber attacks,
yeah,
quite often in the media. But what's generally understood as a cyber attack is sort of a criminal doing something, stealing, basically just advanced forms of fraud or ransom or something like that. But you know, you see, I think militaries really are taking cyber seriously. But I think there's sort of this I was speaking to someone today about this, about how there's kind of a low barrier to entry for cyber crime. In that it's quite easy to, you can go on the dark web and you can find a criminal who will lend you their like botnet for a few hours to launch a cyber denial of service attack. And that's quite easy. That's quite a low barrier to entry. But if you want to do something really serious like Stuxnet, so for those listeners who aren't aware, Stuxnet was a cyber attack likely carried out by the Americans and maybe with some help from the Israelis against an Iranian nuclear refinement facility where they used a worm to alter the spinning of nuclear refining centrifuges, so they span too fast, and basically lots of them broke faster than they could be replaced and stuff, and it just put the Iranian nuclear program back many years, and that's obviously quite sophisticated, because you have to know a lot about the target and what you're going to do, and it's a very precise and targeted sort of attack. The way in which the program or the software was written was that it could only affect that. I mean, it infected a lot of different computers and thousands of millions probably, but it could only really do any damage on that precise system.
Yeah,
because it was so well developed, and developing something so well requires lots of expertise, lots of time, lots of money, lots of investment. What we might call cyber warfare operations, proper things that have violent consequences. They don't want to use them all the time, if militaries have them, they want to keep them because it's basically a one shot deal.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, we might be slightly crossed wires here at the way I'm sort of describing this, but yeah, because I was just thinking of it in terms of sort of just the perception of how we see military operations, perhaps. I mean, I'm just wondering. I mean, are those hackers? I don't call them hackers, really. But those programs, are they military personnel? In the same way as you might treat a soldier, for example, are they a combatant?
If they belong to an armed force, then yeah.
But this is where I suppose it goes back to our blur, because I'm still fresh from our previous podcast. I'm still fresh in this idea of where the blurring between the civilian and the combatant. And think about drone operators who can go home, and then suddenly they become civilians when they're at home. Or don't they? I don't know. But that's just this other concept. Then you're thinking, well, in cyberspace, actually, there's another question then, to what extent is that person a combatant? To what extent is where they're operating from a sort of military space? Lots of blurred questions, which then apply to the whole Space Force thing. I know, so I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here. So to bring it back to Space Force, because I think it is really interesting, because you are suddenly extending the military out into this whole new sphere. Obviously, the military's had a lot of interactions already with outer space, but you're almost formalising that now.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, is it quite scary or is it just a sort of natural progression?
I guess it sort of has to be. It's a natural progression in terms of if you think about military thinking and military interests sort of is ever expanding. We see the militarisation of basically everything in American life. And then that's a domino effect to the rest of the world, particularly to American allies. So I thought in that sense it's quite a natural thing to do, but then it begs the question of, well, why does the military need to expand its interests? It's about securitization, really, I think.
I guess so. I was just wondering as well, is it maybe also because the military is so closely aligned with technological progress that the two go hand in hand, and you almost can't separate them anyway.
Maybe, yeah. I suppose it certainly definitely used to be, didn't it, when military research contracts were the big things that researchers wanted, because they were the mega bucks of the research, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Whereas now, the mega bucks of research are often in private technology companies.
Which then in themselves might therefore also feed into military research. I don't...
Well, yeah, because I mean, you know, lots of them are interested in winning military contracts, but it's not like, you know, 50 years ago, if your company won a military contract, you were probably set for life, whereas now it's just one contract amongst many.
Yeah, and well, I was also thinking of the fact that, well, a lot of this research that we're doing today is actually, it's got its roots in warfare. I'm thinking mainly like the Rand Corporation, for example, and yeah, because I mean, the Rand Corporation has been sort of the big one that sort of came alongside, sort of, you've got the idea of Sputnik 57. Leading to the sort of expansion of all this sort of stuff, which is basically the Americans' response to being outwitted by the Russians. So their idea is actually we're going to power even more money into military research because we're never going to get caught out again. So that's part of the idea of being always proactive in a sense of, and that's the thing with technological war and security studies. I suppose you're always trying to be more proactive because you're trying to outguess the opposition in a way, which is problematic in itself, of course, but. Of course, you've got to protect against the threat because the threat's always going to be there. So, and you'll never know what the threat is until the threat emerges. So you're always escalating.
Yeah,
in a way.
Yeah. I suppose that's a consequence of military thinking and looking for threats. And you know, lots of military people are essentially paid to be paranoid. Yeah, but I suppose then obviously that begs the question of, well, should we be thinking this way? And, should we not be thinking about how to end sort of conflicts and stuff?
Yeah,
well, anyway, well, I suppose
there is that.
I suppose it's the inherent logic of military establishments and military industrial conflict is accepts war as a fact, as it's something that's going to happen. And
yeah,
well, people say they think it is a natural thing that human beings do, don't they?
Yeah,
thinking back to ideas of tribes just. Going at it because over resources and stuff.
Is it just an essential part of human nature that we can't escape from?
Well, that's what a lot of people think, isn't it?
Dark and dystopian, so we just have to sort of guard ourselves against it at all times.
Maybe.
So, I mean, just going back to this question of space force, I know we've been quite tangential here and I've been throwing stuff out there. Is there actually any advantage to having a separate space force to not just using NASA and the American Air Force as it is? I mean, or is it just a political game and sort of Trump wants to distract from his impeachment trial and all the other sort of global tensions that are going on in China, Russia and Iran?
Well, I think there's an advantage to be gained from not using NASA for military purposes. I think NASA is a civilian agency and has to remain so. I don't think there should be links there, with military civilian links there, apart from, you know, legitimate research exchange and that type of, you know, I don't think NASA should be involved in warfare, basically. But in terms of, is there an advantage from taking the Space Force out of the Air Force? Not really, because they're going to do the same job. And they would, you know, it doesn't seem like, I suppose if you think it was going to happen, it's going to happen one day. Well, why not now?
Yeah, true.
You know, you might as well do it now. But yeah, in terms of, are their jobs going to change? I don't think so. In fact, it's probably going to involve more people now because it's now an official thing, and then that means that they require more staff, more administrative staff at a higher level. You know, there's going to be the Americans have sort of political leaders, secretary of the Navy, the Army, and Air Force and stuff, so now you're going to have to be a Secretary of the Space Force.
What can they do? What powers they have? I mean, you recruit a load of soldiers, I mean, what do you do with them? You're not sending them into space, are you?
Well, yeah.
That's why it's so crazy to me.
So it seems like there's going to be this greater level of sort of administrative and bureaucratic, you know, people who sit at the top, but actually they're not going to, the actual core role of what they're doing is probably going to be the same as it was when it was just Space Command in the Air Force. So it seems, you know, on that level it seems strange to do it now.
Yeah, something that occurs to me as I'm talking to you is that, of course, in the early days, the very first sort of people in space were test pilots. Essentially, they were recruited because it was assumed that test pilots were the right people to send, even though they didn't really have much control over what they were doing in their sort of spam can type concept. But obviously, these days, the people that go up in space are scientists. They're not really military personnel. Yeah, they might have some titles, but ultimately, they're sent up for their sort of knowledge and their ability to sort of take part in sort of experiments and so forth. And I just want it's a weird shift, isn't it, to suddenly bring about this space force? Because again, because I'm thinking, you wouldn't normally just send a sort of a military person up into space for any reason, because it's very expensive to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, I wonder. I presume, in a very wide sense, definitely. But I wonder if there's a more particular reason, sort of the privatisation of space.
Yes,
and that we see companies like SpaceX and whatever Jeff Bezos' firm's called, making private rockets for private spaceflight, and buying for contracts with NASA for rockets and various other things. I wonder if there is going to be the Space Force is going to sort of play a role with that.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually, that I hadn't really considered as I was coming up with these thoughts off the top of my head.
But I mean, I don't know what, because if you think about sort of ships, merchant ships being sort of, there's an idea that the Navy comes about because merchant ships of that country start being attacked by pirates. But there aren't space pirates.
No. I mean, are they trying to preempt?
Maybe.
Because again, as you say, it becomes an enforcement tool then. So if there is sort of conflict between two powers, Jeff Bezos and whoever else wants to be fighting in outer space, then the American government and its allies have got a sort of a force, inverted commas, if you will, that has some sort of jurisdiction. But maybe even, I'm thinking, maybe, will it be like a military police almost, where maybe they could perhaps go into, say, the Amazon launch pads and oversee what's going on to check there's no sort of dodgy dealings going on? Because, I mean, that's the thing, they've got these green camouflage outfits. I'm just wondering, yeah, because do they foresee their role as being mainly actually terrestrial-based, and is it like an enforcement agency almost?
Yeah, maybe.
Like sort of a border agency, but maybe a space agency, sort of space force.
I don't know, because there must be already be... NASA must already be doing some sort of regulation in terms of... because ultimately SpaceX and whatever Jeff Bezos' company are called that we can't remember the name of, and whoever else...
GalacticX.
Is it
GalacticX? It's just up to...
Virgin Galactic or whatever. NASA isn't going to buy a rocket that doesn't fit to their standards or isn't fit for what they want it for. So there must be some... NASA must have some sort of regulatory role, whether that's de jure or de facto. It would seem strange in a way that the Space Force would get involved in regulation or policing of sort of this private enterprise unless they're also going to buy those rockets. But then it would be on the same level as NASA in terms of...
Well, that's what I'm thinking.
A contract basis rather than like if they're going to send inspectors round.
Yeah.
That wouldn't seem to be the role.
No, it's just absolutely fascinating because there are so many questions, because obviously NASA don't really use reusable spacecraft so much anymore, do they? I mean, they sort of dropped the whole sort of... Because, I mean, obviously we've still got the International Space Station, which is still a massive sort of thing. That's sort of the main human activity in outer space, really. Most of it's done by robots, which again raises a series of questions. I mean, are these people just going to be essentially operators, like for space drones? You wonder. I mean, it's just so many questions to ask, because it's really expensive to send a human into outer space, and it's really dangerous.
Yeah.
Until we start colonising the moon and we have some sort of proper operations out there, there doesn't seem to be an obvious purpose for the human being in outer space, other than the research purposes we've got in the space station. But, yeah, I mean, are they jumping a gun too early? Are they going to be developing parallel to NASA, or are they sharing NASA's developments, or are they just going to buy Jeff Bezos' ships and Elon Musk and... Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I just don't know where it's going to go.
Well, watch this space.
Yeah, I mean, watch this space quite literally, yeah. I mean, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.